Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
What are you waiting for? Just let it go!
We only shot that scene for one day, and it was only one side of coverage that we shot. I think a wide master and then one side. I think my coverage, maybe. We didn't shoot the other coverage for a year. We didn't get back to that scene for an entire year. Pretty insane.
Welcome to That Scene with me, Dan Patrick, an Amazon original podcast where I get to talk to Hollywood's top actors and directors about some of the most iconic scenes that have defined their careers, helped shape the cinematic landscape, and even become fixtures in pop culture. On today's show, we're joined by actor and producer Elijah Wood. He was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa in 1981, began acting when he was 8 years old, gained recognition as a child actor in films like Back to the Future Part 2, Avalon, and Radio Flyer. In July of 1999, Elijah was cast as Frodo Baggins in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. The films were directed by Peter Jackson, and all three were shot simultaneously over a nearly four-year span. The film series was a worldwide phenomenon and is largely considered to be one of the most successful film series in history. Elijah now runs a production company called Spectravision that focuses primarily on psychological thriller and horror films. His most recent film, No Man of God, stars Luke Kirby as a serial killer, Ted Bundy, and Elijah as FBI profiler Bill Hagemeyer. The scene in question today comes at the end of the third Lord of the Rings movie, The Return of the King, where Frodo and Sam have arrived at the fires of Mount Doom to finally destroy the One Ring. Who destroys the ring?
Well, I mean, technically, it's a combination of Frodo and Gollum.
I don't think I want technically here.
I mean, it's Frodo. If Frodo hadn't made it up to the top of the mountain into Mount Doom, holding it over the precipice, it never would have been destroyed. He's the one that took the journey. If there had been some interjection of Gollum, that would have happened a long time prior. So it's Frodo. But in that very last moment, obviously, Frodo decides to keep the ring for himself and does succumb to its power right before he's to throw it into the fiery pit. And look, you know, Frodo also wouldn't have made it up the mountain had it not been for Sam. There's no way he would have done it on his own. There's no way. You know, so Sam is also very much the hero in that story.
I wonder if we'll ever be put into songs or tales.
What?
I wonder if people will ever say, let's hear about Frodo and the ring. And they'll say, yes, it's one of my favorite stories.
Frodo was really courageous, wasn't he, Dad?
Yes, my boy. The most famousest of hobbits. And that's saying a lot.
You've left out one of the chief characters. Samwise the Brave. I want to hear more about Sam.
Did it feel like that was the end of the journey?
That particular sequence, shooting it?
Yeah.
No.
And did you shoot it in order?
No.
Oh, how tough is that, though?
Oh, man. Well, we shot all three films at once, and we started shooting in October of 1999, only scenes from The Fellowship of the Ring. So we were shooting only Fellowship for the first month and a half, and then we flew to the South Island to continue shooting scenes that were towards the end of Fellowship. So the orcs storming, the hobbits escaping, Boromir being killed, all of that was filmed in the South Island near Queenstown shortly before our Christmas break. But when we went down there, there was a pretty intense rainstorm and flooding that had flooded a number of our sets away. And so we had to shoot wet weather cover. Wet weather cover was a scene from Return of the King on the steps of Cirith Ungol with Frodo, Sam, and Gollum, whom Andy Serkis wasn't there yet. Frodo is very much untrusting of Sam, is very much succumbing to the power of the ring. Very different. And I hadn't, nor had any of us really thought a great deal about that part of the film or that part of the story yet, because we knew we had a little time to get there. It was kind of overnight that we had to sort of figure it out and sit with Peter and Sean and talk about it. You know, there's a great deal of trepidation of like, I just hadn't thought about Frodo yet. Of course, I had thought about it, but the practicality of it seems so distant. We only shot that scene for one day, and it was only one side of coverage that we shot. I think a wide master and then one side. I think my coverage, maybe. We didn't shoot the other coverage for a year. We didn't get back to that scene for an entire year. Pretty insane.
Here, just rest a bit.
I'm all right.
No. No, you're not all right. You're exhausted. It's that golem. It's this place. It's that thing around your neck. I could help a bit. I could carry it for a while.
Carry it for a while.
I could carry it. Share the load. Share the load. The load. The load.
Get away! I don't want to keep it. I just want to help.
And you build up to say goodbye to a character. People don't understand you're saying goodbye to this character that you've embodied for years. So I don't know how that, if you don't shoot it sequentially, like emotionally, how are you when you should be, or at least we think, oh, this is it. You're saying goodbye to Mr. Frodo.
Interestingly enough, my last shot of principal photography, because obviously we did go back and shoot additional footage for each individual film, but my last shot that I wrapped on was actually incredibly appropriate and very much a goodbye scene. Frodo finishing writing The Lord of the Rings and signing it off before he gives the book to Sam. Very much symbolically a goodbye moment and deeply emotional. I remember Peter crying. I was emotional. To your question, oddly, I did have, despite the fact that we shot everything so much out of sequence, I really did have a moment as my last shot that was very symbolically a goodbye. And it was so steeped in emotion of not wanting to say goodbye to New Zealand, not wanting to say goodbye to the character, not wanting to say goodbye to Pete and Fran and this incredible cast. All of that subtext was underneath that moment. Pretty wild.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. And The Lord of the Rings by Frodo Baggins. You finished it.
Not quite. There's room for a little more.
How do you get to the point where you're going to do your audition tape? Like get into the moment of trying to capture Mr. Frodo?
I felt like it was the only thing I could do to have some leg up over everyone else who was auditioning. It was this moment of realizing that I didn't want to be another person in a small white office room with the, you know, acting opposite a casting director. And no offense to that process, because that's the process, you know. But I also just knew hundreds and thousands of people were auditioning for Lord of the Rings. And I just wanted to do something that would articulate my enthusiasm and passion for it and maybe stand out a little. And the only thing I could think of was to take control of that process and make my own tape. And this is, you know, people did make their own tapes then. It wasn't as common as it is now. Self-tapes are so common now. But it just occurred to me that was the only thing I could do. So I told my agent, and she was, I think, a little nervous. Like, okay.
Were you supposed to go in for an actual In the White Room audition?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to. So Victoria Burroughs was the U.S. casting director out of Los Angeles. And so, yes, I could have gone in and auditioned. But it wouldn't have been for Peter, because Peter was traveling around the world meeting various actors at different parts, responding to actors that he had also seen tapes of. So I just thought, okay, so in lieu of meeting Peter, which is not going to happen for a first audition, Yeah, I just didn't want to go into a casting office. I got a book on hobbits and sort of just, you know, drawings of Middle Earth characters. And I went to Western Costume, or this costume house here in LA, and I gathered sort of an approximation of what that would look like, which is not dissimilar, actually, to what I wore in the film. My friend George Wang, who wrote and directed Swimming with Sharks and who's a writer and director, he offered to help with another friend of ours. There were three audition scenes. They were all kind of loosely based on scenes that ultimately made it to the films but weren't quite exactly the same. One was at Bag End with Gandalf, and the other two were with Samwise at varying stages of the journey, sort of trying to sort of show the descent of the character, starting at one very positive, healthy place and then ending up quite disturbed by the ring. And so we filmed one scene at home and then went out into Griffith Park and shot the other two scenes. And they were shot, instead of it being just one single angle, they were shot at varying angles so that we could cut them together and they would function like, you know, cinematic scenes. I brought the cut scenes the following day to Victoria Burrow's office and dropped the VHS tape off.
VHS.
Yeah, before you burn DVDs. I don't know if I have a copy still. And if I do, I don't know where it is, which is kind of wild. Like, I haven't seen it in 22 years. It's wild.
Why do you think you got the role?
I can't answer that question. I don't know.
You never asked Peter, what did you see in me?
I've heard that he saw it and saw a spark of Frodo in that performance. I re-auditioned. I had a what one would call a callback when Peter came to town. And so I actually did get to meet him and Fran, his wife, and audition for them. And one of the best parts of that process wasn't the meeting Peter and Fran and auditioning for them, although that was incredible. It was actually sitting in kind of a waiting room at the office. One of Victoria's assistants walked by and commented on the tape that I had sent and told me that he could really tell that I was passionate about the role in the project through what I had done. And that was kind of it. That actually made me emotional. I remember tearing up at that because that was what I had wanted to achieve. You know, my intent was I was going out on a limb. I'd never really done anything quite like that before. And here was this person affirming for me that the very thing I was trying to achieve had been achieved. That feeling of having set out to do something and it had been received in kind was really gratifying.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
What do people say to you on the street? Like, do you get a common comment?
I mean, there's the ubiquitous or the sort of ubiquity of Frodo being mentioned. If there's to be a commonality in regards to the interactions, that tends to be the reference point.
But how does that work?
Are you the guy from Lord of the Rings or were you Frodo?
Do you get any quotes thrown to you?
Do I get any quotes? I get keep your secrets a bit, because that had become a meme, I guess, that I was not very familiar with. It had to be brought to my attention.
He's up to something. All right, then, keep your secrets.
Good.
I know you have something to do with it.
Good gracious, man.
Before you came along, we Bagginses were very well thought of.
Indeed.
Never had any adventures or did anything unexpected.
If you're referring to the incident with the dragon, I was barely involved.
Mr. Frodo, as if coming from Sam, would be something that someone would say, for sure.
Do you try to distance yourself from Lord of the Rings?
There was never really an attempt to. I think my only concern after, if there was to be a concern with those movies and the success of them, was would I be overly associated with the one character that it would be a hindrance for me to play anything else or to continue working as an actor and developing, which, you know, was just a fear just associated with, I guess, being typecast or being stuck in people's imaginations. So my answer to that or my reaction to that was just to simply keep working on films that were really different. And we had breaks as those movies were coming out. We would go back to New Zealand every year for about 2 months of additional shooting for each individual film. But we had the bulk of our year free to work on other things. And so I just did that. I just worked on other movies so that I wouldn't be overly associated with that one character, but also just because I wanted to keep working. Like, you know, the notion of distancing myself was never something that occurred to me, because I think there was an acceptance pretty early on after the first one had been released that this would be a part of my life forever. Not only an acceptance, but a sense of gratitude. I don't get annoyed if people ask me about Frodo or ask me about the films. It doesn't bristle me that they're not asking about my most recent film. I get it. I love those films too. And they also represent some of the best experiences I've ever had in my life, and living in New Zealand, making some of my best friends, you know, those films encapsulate so much more than the movies themselves. There's a lot of memories of the making of those films that are wrapped up into that in a really profound way. So I love talking about them. I get people's continued interest. And one of the lovely aspects of having been a part of something like that is that I hear people's stories of connection all the time. People tell me how every year they would watch it with their family, and those are some of their fondest memories, or they met their significant other because of a shared bond over the movies. I hear stories like that all the time, and what a lovely thing to be a part of something that provides connection to other people too, you know?
I was wondering if you ever talked to Daniel Radcliffe. Are there parallels, do you feel like, with being a part of something so large and at a young age, and that is what you're known for?
Oh, for sure. We had met once on the set of Prisoner of Azkaban, I think that's how you pronounce it, the third Harry Potter film that Alfonso Cuarón directed. And we meaning folks from Lord of the Rings, were in London at the time recording our ADR for probably the Two Towers, I would have thought. So we had a set visit and I met him then. But this was before people were mistaking the two of us for each other, which happens still to this day. But we recently interviewed each other for Empire Magazine for this big anniversary of Lord of the Rings, and also the first Harry Potter release was in the same year, which is kind of incredible. Both films, the first movies, came out that Christmas. And we'd never talked about it. We'd never talked to each other about what it was like to be a part of something like that. And, you know, he was much younger than me. His entire childhood into adulthood was through the lens of those films. And they made six, seven films. I mean, I had a comparable experience in that I was 18 and 22 by the end of it. So it was almost like a university experience. But we definitely talked about it and the impact that that had on our lives and where we are now. I mean, Daniel he's such an incredible actor, and also he's a cinephile and clearly a fan of a lot of different kinds of movies. And the choices that he's made over the years creatively are so thrilling. He's so established himself as being so many other things than that thing. And I think he was probably also very conscious of making those choices, you know?
What did you keep from Lord of the Rings?
I was given the ring. Peter and Fran gave me the ring upon returning to New Zealand for pickups in the first film.
Is it just one ring, or did they have a stunt double?
They had a lot of rings.
Okay. That was Lord of the Rings, plural.
Yeah, they had rings of different sizes, too. They had a really giant ring for certain close-ups. I have Sting, and I have a pair of feet, and I have the last clapper for the last shot of the last scene that I was in. I got a map of Middle Earth, I think, from Bag End. There were some incredible props in Bag End.
Had you worked with Peter Jackson prior to seeing Peter Jackson's movies?
No, I'd seen Frighteners, Brain Dead, and Heavenly Creatures prior to working with him.
So he goes from those kind of movies to doing Lord of the Rings, and you go from Lord of the Rings to maybe doing some of those kind of movies, almost in reverse.
That's funny. It's interesting when you think about genre and horror on a larger scale. Many great filmmakers get their start in genre. It's an easy way to cut your teeth. Spielberg, obviously, Peter Jackson. David Lynch still works in genre on some level. Sam Raimi very famously got his start in genre as well. It's cheap to make horror movies, and it's an incredibly easy format and medium to get financed and therefore have a degree of creative freedom to work out who you are as a filmmaker. So it kind of makes sense.
But James Cameron did Piranha, didn't he?
I think you're right. So yeah, there's another example.
So you've done it in reverse order. Was that by design that you went from something huge to maybe something that you downsized?
No, that notion, that sort of bigger, smaller, wasn't at all something I took into account. It's just simply, I wanted to produce. I love this process of making films, and I love the creative process and working with a group of creative people towards a common goal. I have loved that as an actor and being sort of tangentially as an actor associated with the larger picture and wanting to be involved in a movie's inception and seeing it through production to post-production for a long time. And meeting my producing partners and recognizing that we had a shared mutual love of horror and genre films that sort of clarified that vision of what I wanted that to be, just because I love those kinds of movies. And I believe that those movies, that great horror and genre, don't have to be relegated to the B camp. I think great art can be made in the context of genre films. And great art every year is made in under the sort of pretext of genre. That isn't necessarily bigger or smaller, it's just cinema. I don't think about sort of descending from the mountain into...
Literally.
into this realm of horror and genre. It's just, you know, when I wanted to start a production company, the kinds of movies and filmmakers that I wanted to support happened to be working within that realm, I think.
When did you fall in love with horror movies?
When I was young. I have the benefit of having an older brother who's 7 years older than me. So he and his friends would rent movies from the local video store that invariably would be genre and horror movies. And he would like invite me to watch them on the sort of promise that I wouldn't tell our parents.
What movies do you remember?
Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, were probably when I was like 6. I remember that, loving it. There's a movie called Truth or Dare, A Critical Madness, that was a direct-to-VHS movie made by a filmmaker called Tim Ritter. That still is a movie that I love that was I probably saw when I was 5 or 6. Those are the two that kind of really stand out. Gremlins, I definitely saw.
Did you see Brain Dead?
Yeah, I love Brain Dead. I saw Brain Dead after seeing Heavenly Creatures, which I think was the first Peter Jackson movie I saw. Then I saw Brain Dead after that because I'd loved Heavenly Creatures. But yeah, Brain Dead's amazing.
How did you decide on Nicolas Cage for Mandy?
So I had worked with Nick on a movie called The Trust as an actor, had an incredible experience working with him. We would have these conversations about genre and horror films, and he knew I had this company, Spectrevision, and he was keen on what we were doing. We would sort of recommend movies to each other. And at that time, we were putting Mandy together and trying to get it made. And we spoke to Panos about Nick, and he loved the idea of Nick. And so I actually recommended that Nick watch Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is Panos' first film. And it blew his mind and like freaked him out and gave him nightmares, I think. And he went to meet Panos in Vancouver, I believe, with Panos wanting to cast him as Jeremiah Sand, who is the cult leader in the film. of the Children of the New Dawn, sort of the central villain. Nick didn't see it, didn't see a way into that particular character for himself.
He wanted to play the hero.
And I think he wanted to play the hero. But he was really specific about not feeling like he knew the way into that role, but that he loved Red. And so then it was, you know, because Panos had his mind set on him for Jeremiah, it was sort of a rethink. And then he kind of called us and said, I'm an idiot. Of course. Yeah, let's get him for Red. It'd be amazing.
That was my favorite shirt.
Nick sort of jumped at the chance to jump back in because he loved the script and loved the character and obviously was confident in Panos as a filmmaker. You know, that's the great thing about Nick. This is an actor who has such an extraordinary career and is still so moved to work on something that interests him. The motivation is wanting to work with filmmakers that he feels are exciting and vital and will, you know, provide a platform for him. And that's awesome.
No man of God comes across your table. What comes first, that you may want to act in it or you may want to produce it?
Produce it. That came to us as a script that we fell in love with. As with anything that I and we read for our company, I never ever think about that material from the perspective of acting in them. It always has to be brought to my attention after the fact. So anytime I've ever worked on any of our films as an actor, it's always been relatively late in the process that a producing partner will sort of say, hey, or the writer or somebody else or the director would ask. That was the case with No Man of God as well. We had been trying to get the movie made, you know, the typical time it takes sometimes for independent films to get made, somewhere around 4 years. And it was sort of as it was coming together and we found financing, it was around then that I was asked to look at it from that perspective. And, you know, it was an easy yes. I love the script and the dynamic between Bill and Ted and their conversations were endlessly fascinating to me. And the opportunity to play Bill Hagmeyer in the film was really exciting.
I'm not playing games. I'm coming clean. And if that means bringing other states into the mix, then so be it.
How many?
Five.
Not how many states, how many girls?
Am I talking about?
How many did you kill?
That.
Yes, that.
Let's say 30.
Let's say we talk about the real number.
30 is a nice round number.
How many?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I didn't keep score. And it gets confusing.
I don't understand what gets so confusing.
I'm not even sure all of them are dead.
Luke Kirby's spectacular.
He's incredible.
I don't know if when you're shooting, if you're watching somebody and in your mind you're going, holy shit. Like how many times has that happened to you where you're watching something, you're actually in the scene where it hits you almost as if you're a viewer?
It happens. It doesn't happen a lot. I think you're referring to the sort of uncanniness of how he embodies Ted in ways that are very, very accurate. That happened watching him. I've seen a lot of interview footage with Ted Bundy. I've since I was a teenager. So I have the image of Ted in a variety of ways in my head already. So working opposite Luke and in these moments where you see these flashes of Ted come to life in front of you, it definitely minor out-of-body experiences for sure.
Because sometimes you can have somebody imitate somebody, and then other times somebody is actually somebody. And there's a big difference, I think, in that feeling of when you watch somebody, they are that person. They're not trying to be that person.
Yeah, there is a distinction. And I think Luke was never trying to imitate. And I think, you know, it was clear from Amber, too, that she wasn't interested in imitation from either of us. And obviously, there's less material for me to glean in regards to Bill Hagmeyer than there is for Ted Bundy. And certainly people's familiarity with Ted is far greater. But she wasn't interested in that. She just wanted truth. And yet there are so many moments in the film where Luke really does embody Ted in a pretty profound way.
And you got style-wise comparison, Silence of the Lambs, Manhunter. Do you feel those comparisons with it?
It's an honor if those are, Manhunter is one of my favorites. My God, what an incredible movie. Yeah, I mean, should there be any comparisons to those films? That That's a
Michael Mann would be very happy that that you love Manhunter. How's that?
Oh, Manhunter's just genius, man. That film is so, so great. And Brian Cox's interpretation of Hannibal Lecter is fantastic. It's so good and so different. Really wonderful.
Thank you. Very generous in looking back. And good luck with No Man of God.
Thank you.
I hope people get a chance just to see, you know, the performance there, because there's some really great performances there.
Oh, cheers.
Elijah, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. That was lovely. Appreciate it.
New episodes of That Scene are available exclusively on Amazon Music. And all of season one is available wherever you get your podcasts. So make sure you follow us in the Amazon Music app. That Scene with Dan Patrick, created, hosted, produced by me. Our showrunner and producer is Brendan Pike, edited by Nathan Moody. The show is executive produced by Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood. Our associate producers, Bill Ryan and Marvin Prince. That Scene is an Amazon original and a production of Dan Patrick Productions.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.